So my name is José Bové. Listen to health writers if you are concerned about the health of the body politic.
This is health writer Rob Lewis. Today's show focuses on the environment. With the latest news of Walker's plan to dramatically change the focus of environmental policy in Wisconsin from protecting our air, water, and land towards freeing up business to exploit the environment, we will spend time reflecting deeply on what an alternative kind of environmental thinking should look like. First, you'll hear Steve Blank interview Heather Rogers, world-traveling environmentalist and policy critic, as well as author of Green Gone Wrong. We'll hear health writer Tom reflect on the seriousness of the crisis of climate change we face. And finally, we'll end with my segment, which reflects more deeply on the meaning of environmentalism.
I'm speaking with Heather Rogers, author of Green Gone Wrong. We live in a consumer society, and people buy things all the time, and that's what keeps the economy moving. Because we face an environmental crisis, product developers are now producing all kinds of new products, like hybrid automobiles and energy-saving light bulbs, that promise to save the planet by reducing our individual carbon footprints. Heather Rogers, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, Steve, one of the main pieces where this plan falls apart is that, you know, we can take those individual actions. We can replace our light bulbs. We can buy organic food. We can drive hybrid cars. But unless there are larger changes to the way that all the things we need in daily life are produced, the resources, you know, the way that they're extracted, how often, you know, something that's unless those kinds of changes aren't initiated, the you know, behavioral shifts that people like you and I make just won't add up.
And what are our leaders proposing to curb climate change and to protect the human habitat?
Well, unfortunately, our leaders are, you know, not doing very much, especially in the United States. One of the big initiatives on the international stage is carbon offsetting and carbon trading, as well as their efforts to slow deforestation through assigning monetary value to existing forests, which essentially is a commoditization of forests, and that has a whole host of issues that are very problematic related to it. But in terms of carbon offsetting, I have spent time in southern India where a large percentage of the world's carbon offset projects are implemented, and there are just all kinds of issues on the ground that we, as consumers, as voters, as individuals sitting over here in front of our computers, just can't really imagine. And, you know, carbon offsetting is just essentially paying to have a carbon neutral, say, power plant built that runs on crop waste, or to have trees planted to sort of absorb the carbon that we emit, the excess carbon that we emit. And, you know, the kinds of things that happen in those places are, I went to a carbon neutral power plant that burns palm fronds, dead grass, you know, the leaves from sugarcane and rice straw. And what's happening there is that the nutrients are being taken off of the soil and being burned, and that's creating the need. It's creating economic hardships for people. They're having to buy fertilizer. They're having to buy firewood. Trees are now being cleared in order to sell these people firewood. Trees are being cleared to sell to the carbon-neutral power plant for fuel. So there's all kinds of knock-on effects that are hard for us to anticipate. It sounds good. Oh, they're building a power plant that's not going to burn coal. What could be wrong with that? And, you know, the reality, the social and environmental implications are much more nuanced and complicated.
Well, it sounds like the people of India are suffering for so many reasons. I know that the farmers there are committing suicide because they're in such debt. All the communities there are suffering. What other communities have you visited?
I went to Paraguay, where there's a large-scale organic sugar plantation that provides a third of all the organic sugar consumed in the United States. You know, and looked at the farming methods there, which brought up issues of, you know, demand for organic food is growing. Everyone knows this. But what happens is, you know, this plantation is just one example. They are expanding their organic cropland, but they're doing that by deforesting native subtropical forests. That's not what people have in mind when they look for the organic seal. I went to other places, including the island of Borneo in Indonesia, where they're deforesting to expand crops to make biodiesel. I've also spent time in the United States for a subsequent article, and I spent time with farmers in Iowa and looked at the social and environmental impact of corn ethanol. And something that was really interesting about talking to those farmers was initially they said, no, we love ethanol. You know, ethanol is the greatest thing since sliced bread. But the more time I spent with them, the more it became clear that actually they don't like ethanol. They like to be able to sell their crops. And at this point, because of the tremendous subsidies that corn ethanol receives, they're able to sell their corn. And there's a tremendous amount of dignity that goes along with that. And what they don't like about ethanol is they don't like agribusiness. They don't like to farm. I mean, I'm not saying every farmer feels this way, but the farmers that I talked to did. And, you know, they want to farm in a way that protects the soil. They want to farm in a way that is about preserving the water supply and, you know, in a more, I mean, they work the land because they love the land, you know, and they see what industrial farming does. And they don't like that. And they also don't like the corporate monopolies that run the agribusiness sector.
Well, that's going on all across the United States, and it hits home right here in Wisconsin. Just this morning, the Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters released a press release saying that our governor, Scott Walker, the infamous Scott Walker, is giving even more power to the head of the Department of Natural Resources. The DNR here in Wisconsin used to be an independent position, but now it's a political appointment. And at this point, he's seeking to give that department even more control so that all the people who work for the Department of Natural Resources will suddenly have to kind of fall in line with the governor's pro-business, pro-industry ideas for what should be happening with the Department of Natural Resources in this state. It's going to be merit-based. Does that ring a bell? Kind of like charter schools. And members of the staff statewide who really don't buy what the director of the DNR is trying to do, face losing their jobs. And this is unprecedented here in Wisconsin. And just this week, the DNR approved a big CAFO, a big industrial farm in Rock County down in Janesville. And all the local farmers are very upset because the water that they used to farm is going to be destroyed. And we face great water issues here in Wisconsin, a lot of contamination. Heather, what needs to happen in order for us to really effectively change the course of climate change? How encompassing do our changes need to be?
Well, our changes need to be, you know, on every level, really. I mean, we need to start from the very basics of the decisions that we make as individuals on a day-to-day basis, but we can't stop there. And with the government that we've got, you know, with the Obama administration and the current Congress, those are the only kinds of changes that are really happening, unfortunately. We need that. We also need an effective regulation, you know, that holds industries and businesses accountable in ways that will allow, for example, farmers like the men and women that I met in Iowa, to allows them to farm the way that they want to farm and allows for that to be economically sustainable. So also, you know, farming in a holistic way isn't something that you can do if you have an off-farm income or an inheritance, because those kinds of farmers don't earn a living. I write about this in my book. They don't earn a living wage, and that needs to change. And we can do that through farm policy shifts. So there are those kinds of changes that can happen on the level of regulation. And, you know, there's other kinds of changes that are crucial to allowing a greater, you know, greater democracy in our system. And those have to do with campaign finance reform and our trade policies. There needs to be those kinds of policy changes as well.
And you think that these changes are possible in a capitalist system?
You know, obviously, these changes are incredibly difficult in a capitalist system. You know, we're talking about the most powerful industries in human history, the oil industry, you know, big ag, big coal, big oil. And, you know, these people, these interests are not going to cede any ground. They don't want to, and at this point, they don't seem to have to. You know, they have been able to find politicians that are very willing to defend them directly and indirectly. It's very challenging to deal with a government like the Obama administration that is really good at greenwashing. You know, it's not just companies that greenwash, it's also politicians. When you try to green a market system that's based on deriving wealth from the extraction of resources from nature, I don't know how you can do that in a way. You know, a lot of people say we can shift to a green economy, we can grow, we can have ongoing increase in profits and return on investment and all this kind of stuff, but we just replace dirty products for clean ones. And this is really what I talk about in my book. This is the kind of main point, is actually, can we really do that? And it's really difficult, and I don't see how you can make a system that fundamentally doesn't value nature, because it can't. If it does adequately value nature, then the whole system of deriving value and surplus value and, you know, the whole system of pricing falls apart. You know, a lot of people talk about true cost pricing, it's called, where you actually charge what it costs to make a stick of butter.
Sure.
Or a computer or
a hamburger or a shirt.
A hamburger, a shirt, those are more common.
I've seen those reports, yeah.
Yeah, so which is in some ways a great idea, but also, you know, and some people are really trying to make that happen. And what I say in my book is that, you know, actually that would never work, because these things would just be impossibly expensive. And so, you know, it's not even about just adjusting things a little bit to try to make the prices of things, you know, reflect more adequately reflect the cost of production. There needs to be much more fundamental changes, and you know that has to do with redefining our definition of growth. It has to do, in my mind, with separating growth from development, so that we can continue to have a good standard of living and not destroy the planet. And I think that we can do that. You know, I heard a report yesterday that said a third of all the food produced in the world is lost or wasted. That's the kind of waste I think that we can get rid of. And that, you know, what that means is we need to consume less. And if we can consume less by not wasting a third of the food on the planet, then that means that the quality of life that you and I have doesn't go down. And it means that the quality of life that other people have goes up.
Well, Heather Rogers, I want to thank you. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Heather Rogers, author of Green Gone Wrong. Get the book from your library, or if you have to buy a copy, buy it from your local independently owned bookstore. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you, Steve.
Now at midnight, all the agents and the superhuman crew come out and round up everybody that knows more than they do.
Politics of Climate Change. In 2007, the Intergovernment Panel on Climate stated, quote, "Warming of the climate system is unequivocal as is now evident from observations of increases in global average air and ocean temperatures, widespread melting of snow and ice, and rising global average sea levels, unquote. In 2010, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recorded the warmest year on record, that tied 2005, capping the warmest decade in which 19 nations set all-time records, the most ever. Hottest temperature was recorded in Pakistan at 128 degrees Fahrenheit. Lack of science literacy by the American public, politicians, colleges, and the media has led to the greatest man-made crisis in history. Scientific theory is not a guess or belief, but an explanation supported by existing evidence. Climate change is not only affecting the rising temperatures, ocean levels, flooding, heat waves, extreme weather conditions such as hurricanes and tornadoes, but is disrupting crops, forest, and marine life. It has now been discovered that the weight of melting glaciers is contributing to the shifting of the Teutonic plates, resulting in more earthquakes, tsunamis, and volcanic eruptions. It is creating public health problems, like the tripling of childhood asthma rates in the U.S. as a result of rising concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, as well as greater risk for infectious diseases, warned Dr. Paul Epstein, Associate Director of the Center of Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. There are parallels between Americans who believe in climate change is a reality and religious and political ideologies. 48% of Americans do not believe climate change is a reality. 68% of Republicans are not concerned about climate change, while 53% said there's no evidence of climate change. 34% said it is a result of human activity. 40% of religious people do not believe in the scientific theory of evolution. 38% of religious people believe disasters are signs from God. 40% believe disaster is God's way of testing faith. The myth of climate change in America is perpetuated by both religious and political ideologies, with the backing of most energy corporations, business organizations, other corporations, their lobbyists, and the national media. Drastic changes to reduce carbon and other chemical emissions by American and international laws will negatively affect corporate profits, so they are not concerned what it does to the earth or its people. For Health Writers, this is Thomas Kozlowski.
That was sound captured from the side of the road at the UW Arboretum, a space set aside just west of the UW-Madison campus for the restoration of ecosystems, where modern human activities are limited, but still present, as you can hear from the sound of the car. In thinking about today's topic, the environment, a key question that comes to mind is, what is our relationship as humans to nature? Rather than trying to outright answer such a deep question, this segment seeks to explore the multiple ways in which it can be approached. Those who take the question about our relationship to nature literally and study our current interactions with the environment see an imbalance in this relationship, particularly in the way that we exploit the environment, from mining to energy consumption and the resulting environmental destruction this causes. They have a great deal of concern not only about the ailing health of our environment, but also what this means for our survival as a species. There are a wide range of views about exactly how immediate this threat is to the ecological system on which we depend. A perspective which takes the most dire view in this debate is that not only are we destroying the ecosystem upon which we depend, but it is our fundamental way of life in modern industrial civilization which prevents us from having a healthy relationship with nature. Here's a clip from the documentary, NCIV, Resist or Die.
People often say that there is a war against nature and that this is the Third World War.
It's getting more stark. It's getting worse, and the rate of change is accelerating, whether we're talking about the extinction of species or the thoroughness of the technoculture.
The world right now is frankly very frightening. For what we consider to be industrial civilization, I would say, is extraordinarily uncivilized, actually quite savage.
It's not an exaggeration to say that we are living in an ecological apocalypse.
Between the years 1980 and 2045, we will lose more species of plants and animals than have been lost in the last 65 million years.
We have two big picture time pressures that really mean we should be acting a lot more urgently than most of us have. And one of them is peak oil or energy collapse, and one of them is climate change or runaway global warming.
I think that most people, even most scientists, continue to underestimate how far down the path to climate catastrophe we've already traveled.
For the most part, we're oblivious to it. We don't want to know about it. We don't want to hear about it.
The one thing I'm most afraid of is that we're going to mount a tremendous campaign to sustain the unsustainable.
At this point, the scientists are saying that the Earth's temperature may increase by as much as 10 degrees. At that point, there may not even be bacteria left.
When the oil starts to really run dry, and when those in power have to assert their power in a time of dwindling resources, I think they're going to turn to much more blunt and cruel methods of enforcing their power.
The whole climate is changing. The winds, the ocean currents, the storm patterns, snowpack, snow melt, flooding, droughts.
As I explored this question in the UW Arboretum and interviewed people there, I discovered an ethical perspective on the relationship between humans and nature.
The closer we are, the better off we are and the better off the environment is. And by close, I don't mean close as in that looks like a good set of trees to log. But more guessing in the nature of being out and enjoying finding sustenance.
I also spoke with the Outreach and Education Director at the Arboretum, Molly Fightfield Marie, and asked her for her thoughts on the relationship between humans and nature.
Well, the Arboretum actually is a wonderful place to talk about that because our founding director was Aldo Leopold, and we're fairly convinced, or I am anyway, that one of the first articulations of his famous land ethic was at the dedication of dress for the Arboretum in 1934, June 17th. And the Arboretum is unique in that it is where the whole science of ecological restoration started. And what we now call Curtis Prairie in 1934 was a couple of farm fields, and that Leopold and Fassett and other early pioneers from the university who were interested in ecological restoration began trying to plant a prairie here, but nobody had ever done that. Leopold said in the dedication address that if we are able to restore a prairie here, it will be just the first step in the long and arduous relationship of mutually building a mutually beneficial relationship between humans and the environment.
For more on this land ethic, we can listen to a passage from Leopold's Sand County Almanac performed by an arboretum horticulturalist from Arizona.
You know, there's yet no ethic that deals with man's relation to the land and to the animals and the plants that grow upon it. The relationship is still economic and it entails privileges, but not obligations. All ethics so far have evolved upon a single premise, that the individual is a member of a community of interdependent parts. Now his instincts prompt him to compete for his place in that community, but it's his ethics that prompt him also to cooperate, perhaps just so there's some place to compete for. A land ethic simply enlarges the boundaries from just people to include the soil and the plants and the water and the animals are collectively the land. It expands the human community to include the land and all of its components. A land ethic cannot prevent the alteration, management, and use of soil and water and plants and animals. But it does affirm their right to existence, and at least in spots, their continued existence in a natural state. In short, a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens, that's us, from conqueror of the land community to just a plain member and a citizen of it. It implies respect for his fellow members and also respect for the community as a whole.
Another perspective on the relationship between man and nature is a more philosophical or spiritual perspective. Here's what a man who had come to the Arboretum to eat his lunch had to say.
I think humans should consider themselves part of nature. And when human beings go out into areas like this UW Arboretum, I think that you can find lots of peace and tranquility, and you can kind of forget your everyday troubles. It is definitely a spiritual benefit, so it's very important, I think, for humans to have these places that they can access to enjoy life.
If we think about the historical relationship between humans and the environment, we can look for example to the Native Americans who lived on this very land here in Madison, but with a much closer relationship to the land than we have. This Native way of life and religion revolved around nature. I'd like to end with this explanation of what a Native American elder named Floyd Red Crow had to say about having a spiritual connection with nature.
Time evolves and comes to a place where it renews again. There is first a purification time, then there is renewal time. We are getting very close to this time now. We were told that we would see America come and go. And in a sense, America is dying from within, because they forgot the instructions on how to live on Earth. Over 95% of our body is water. And in order to stay healthy, you've got to drink good water. When the European first came here, Columbus, we could drink out of any river. If the Europeans had lived the Indian way when they came, we'd still be drinking out of water, because water is sacred. The air is sacred. Our DNA is made of the same DNA as the tree. The tree breathes what we exhale. When the tree exhales, we need what the tree exhales. So we have a common destiny with the tree. We are all from the earth. And when the earth, the water, the atmosphere is corrupted, then it will create its own reaction. Mother is reacting. In the Hopi prophecy, they say the storms and floods will become greater. To me, it's not a negative thing to know that there will be great changes. It's not negative. It's evolution. When you look at it as evolution, it's time. Nothing stays the same. You should learn how to plant something. That's the first connection. You should treat all things as spirit. Realize that we are one family.